Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So today we're reading from 26th chapter of the 5th canto entitled A Description of the Hellish Planets. We're on text number 21. Yastviha vai sarva bigamas tam amutra niryate. I'm sorry, niraye vartamanam vajrakantaka shal malim aropya nishkarshanti. Translation. A person who indulges in sex indiscriminately, even with animals, is taken after death to the hell known as Vajrakantaka Shalmali. In this hell there is a silk cotton tree full of thorns as strong as thunderbolts. The agents of Yamaraj hang the sinful man on that tree and pull him down forcefully so the thorns very severely tear his body. Purport. The sexual urge is so strong that sometimes a man indulges in sexual relations with a cow, or a woman indulges in sexual relations with a dog. Such men and women are put into the hell known as Vajrakantaka Shalmali. The Krishna consciousness movement forbids illicit sex. From the description of this verse, we can understand that an extremely sinful act illicit sex is. Sometimes people disbelieve these descriptions of hell, but whether one believes or not, everything must be carried out by the laws of nature, which no one can avoid.
Ladananda Sony Tone, Namo Vishnubarai Shabudale Shimate, Pachipananda Sony Tone, Namaste, Sarsvati Deve, Gorvani Pchaine, Nirvishesha Shunivadi, Pashyatya Deshitaine.
So, currently in this chapter of the descriptions of the hellish planets, there's some very graphic descriptions. Some of the things that we read about based upon our societal enculturation, indoctrination, they don't seem like such a big deal. You know, like if you don't welcome a guest properly, it seems like, oh, well, you know, big deal, you know, I don't welcome a guest. That's not really part of American culture, to be very welcoming of guests. You know, but yet that's actually a very sinful activity. You know, or distribution of prasadam. Most people here in the Western countries, they just cook for themselves and they don't bother thinking about other people. It's normal for them just to, you know, make a family dinner and then enjoy dinner with the family without consideration of other people. So when people from this part of the world hear about these types of hells, oftentimes it can be a little bit shocking, like, oh my God, I go to hell just for having dinner? You know, but it's more than that. You know, like Prabhupada was saying here, that whether one believes or disbelieves in these descriptions of hell, that's not really the issue. Because everything must be carried out by the laws of nature. This is the way this material world is set up. It's not that we really had a choice in it. This is how Krishna designed it. Prabhupada gives the example of a flame, of fire. Just because an innocent child touches the fire, doesn't know any better that the child will be spared. No, the child will be burnt equally. Just like anyone else who has knowledge of fire will be burnt. So in the same way, these different descriptions of these hellish planets, these affect all living beings no matter what religion we come from, no matter what beliefs we have. This is just how the material world works. It's not some belief. It's just like describing some mechanical machine. You pull this lever, push this button, and then this thing happens. It's not a matter of, well, you know, I don't believe in the green button. I believe in the blue button, but not the green button. You know, it's not like that. This is just a mechanical process. This is how the laws of nature work. And so it all boils down to, it all comes back to bodily concept of life. You know, in the Gita, Krishna says, Prakrite kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvashaha ahankara vimudatma kartaham iti manyate. The spirit soul, bewildered by the influence of the false ego, thinks himself the doer of activities that are in actuality carried out by the three modes of material nature. You know, so this is the root of where all the problems come from. We're identifying with this material body composed of the earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. And we think that we're doing all these different activities that we're experiencing, but really, all we're experiencing is just the interactions of the three modes of material nature. So when Mahavishnu glances over the Pradhan and activates the three modes of material nature, then these three modes of material nature, they start vying, competing for dominance. At no one time is anything under purely one mode of material nature. That's not possible. But one mode will be more dominant than the other two modes. So when the mode of ignorance is predominant, then the modes of passion and goodness are subdued. When the mode of goodness is predominant, the modes of ignorance and passion are subdued. Same way with the mode of passion. And so based upon our association with these different modes of material nature, because that's really what it is, we're associating with these modes of material nature. And based upon that association, we come under the influence of those modes. Just like in Krishna consciousness, we hear from the previous acharyas how important association is. That even 1/11th of a second association with a pure devotee is so powerful that it can give you liberation. Not only that, if you have association with a pure devotee, Krishna will actually submit himself to you, which is really incredible. Krishna makes that statement in the Uddhava Gita in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam. And instead of just making that statement, Krishna also gives a list of so many great devotees who became great devotees not because of any austerities, not because of great learning, not because of any wonderful accomplishments, not because of anything they did except for having the association of a pure devotee. So association is really the most important factor in spiritual life. And as we can see, when we associate with these different modes of nature, we take on their qualities and their characteristics. And so people associating with the modes of ignorance and passion, then they'll engage in activities described in this verse. They'll have sex with animals. They're so indiscriminate in their lust. In fact, they become so indiscriminate that they become mad. In the 5th canto of the Bhagavatam, 5th chapter, text number 4, Lord Shivadev, when he's instructing his sons, he says, Nunam pramatak kurute vikarma yad indriya pritaya aprinoti nasadu manye yata atmanoyam asana piklesada asadeha. When a person considers sense gratification the aim of life, he certainly becomes mad after materialistic living and engages in all kinds of sinful activity. He does not know that due to his past misdeeds, he has already received a body, which, although temporary, is the cause of his misery. Actually, the living entity should not have taken on a material body, but he has been awarded the material body for sense gratification. Therefore, I think it not befitting an intelligent man to involve himself again in the activities of sense gratification, by which he perpetually gets material bodies one after another. So this madness is forcing us, lifetime after lifetime, into the suffering of these material bodies. So that's why just knowing about something isn't sufficient. Because even we can know about it, but due to our insanity, due to our sheer madness, we can't overcome these different desires that we have. Even Kamsa, when he was being... Duryodhana. Even Duryodhana, when he was... Dhritarashtra, the brother of Vidura. When Dhritarashtra was being advised by Vidura, Vidura was giving him all a good instruction, saying, this isn't the proper thing to do. You should tell your sons to relent on their quest for dominance of this kingdom. Really, this kingdom should be inherited by the sons of Pandu, not by your sons. But Dhritarashtra was so blind, both materially and spiritually, that he couldn't accept these instructions. He said, yes, I know your instructions, they're all perfect and good, but despite your instructions, I have to act like this. I'm still going to do it, despite all your good instructions. Even he knows better, but he's so mad after sense gratification that he can't help himself. So this is also one of the most difficult things for those who are aspiring to make some spiritual advancements in Krishna consciousness. When we're coming out of these modes of material nature, as Prabhupada said, once the fan has become unplugged, the fan blades may still spin for some time. You know, in other words, it takes some time for the reactions of those previous sinful activities to subside. And while that's going on, the mind can still be very disturbed, can be perturbed. And so that's why it becomes very difficult, especially for new people, people who've only been here a few years, or even people who've been here a long time. There are so many examples. Because as long as we have this material body, we'll always experience the pushings of the material body. So in the Gita, chapter 2, text 59, Krishna says, Vishaya vinavartante niraharasya dehinaha rasa varjam rasopyasya parangrishta nivartate. The embodied soul may be restricted from sense enjoyment, though the taste for sense objects remains. But ceasing such engagements by experiencing a higher taste, he is fixed in consciousness. This is an extremely important point. Though the taste for sense objects remains, as long as we have this material body and as long as we're struggling here, that taste, even though our senses may be restrained, that taste for those objects remains. And the fact that that taste for those objects remains always poses a danger. It always poses a threat. And so if we become weak-spirited, weak-willed, and weak-minded, if we cave in to the demands for that taste, to satisfy that taste, then that's when people fall down. But then Krishna makes another important point in this verse. He says, but by experiencing a higher taste. That's the important word there, experiencing. Unless we can have this experience of a higher taste, how can we give up these lower tastes? It's not possible. It's impossible to give up one thing without replacing it with another. Very, very difficult. That's why Prabhupada has given so many warnings about the path of empiric knowledge or speculation. Because it's fraught with difficulty. At every single step along the path, there's always the chance of fall down. Because there is no taste. You're not replacing anything. You're not supplementing with something else. All you're doing is you're taking away, you're subtracting. Neti, neti. It's not this, it's not this. Even just with mundane examples, for instance, people who are addicted to smoking cigarettes, they can't just quit smoking cigarettes. They have to replace that with something else. That's oftentimes why you see when somebody quits smoking, all of a sudden they gain a lot of weight. Because they replace that smoking with something else, with eating. You know, or they take up the habit of chewing gum. Or heroin addicts. Oftentimes they go to methadone. Methadone is almost as bad as heroin. And then if you try to get them off methadone, they go on to something else. Many years ago, a friend of mine was addicted to heroin. He was shooting up every day. He became just skinny as a rail. Couldn't even hardly stand on his own two feet because he became so weak. So somehow he managed to get over this addiction. But what happened? He substituted that addiction for drinking alcohol. You know, it's virtually impossible to just give one thing up without substituting another thing for it. Same thing with material enjoyment, sense gratification. It's impossible just to give up sense gratification. Very dry. So many great yogis, so many ascetics, they have tried to do that. They've tried to give up sense gratification without replacing with anything. And then what's the result? After 40,000 years of austerities, by hearing the tinkling of an ankle bell, they fall down. You know, or by seeing some fish engage in the act of mating, then they fall down. Could you imagine just seeing some fish and then you bloop? Because it's impossible just to give up one thing. You have to replace it with something else. So that's why Krishna says, by experiencing this higher taste, then we become fixed in consciousness. That's why it's so important that we actually get this taste. We experience this taste in Krishna consciousness. Because without having this taste, we'll be searching elsewhere for that taste. I've seen it happen in the short time that I've been here. I've seen it happen so many times. People, they're not getting that taste. Their mind is dwelling on having some sort of taste in life. And because they're not necessarily getting it from Krishna consciousness, because you know they may or may not be chanting so nicely, or they may not be applying the principles so nicely, for whatever reason, I don't know. But for whatever reason, then they find themselves so many miles away from the temple, working some lousy job, smoking cigarettes, you know, who knows what else they're doing. Because they go back to where they thought that taste existed before they came to the temple. Punar Mushtika Bhava. So whenever we give up this process of Krishna consciousness, we fall back to wherever we came from. That's why myself, I'm always very fearful to take this process seriously, because I don't want to go back where I came from. I remember what it was like, and it wasn't very fun. Not a nice, pleasant experience. You know, so Arjuna, he asks a very important question of Krishna early, or a little bit later in the Gita. Text 36, in the third chapter, Arjuna asks, O descendant of Vrishni, by what is one impelled to sinful acts, even unwillingly, as if engaged by force? And sometimes this is how it can feel. We're going along, and then it feels almost as if we're being pushed from behind into doing these different activities, like somebody is forcing our hand. And Krishna responds, he says, it's lust only, Arjuna. It's only lust that impels us like this. And so then in text 39, Krishna continues, he says, thus the wise living entity's pure consciousness becomes covered by his eternal enemy in the form of lust, which is never satisfied and which burns like fire. And so it's that burning sensation, that burning of the fire of lust, that forces us into activity because we want to get away from that fire. We want relief from that fire. We think that by engaging in this activity, it will subdue these fires of lust. In the purport, Prabhupada makes a very good point. He says, in the material world, the center of all activities is sex. And thus this material world is called Maitunya Agara, or the shackles of sex life. In the ordinary prison house, criminals are kept within bars. Similarly, the criminals who are disobedient to the laws of the Lord are shackled by sex life. In the very end, he says, while one enjoys sense gratification, it may be that there is some feeling of happiness, but actually, that so-called feeling of happiness is the ultimate enemy of the sense enjoyer. And so we can practically see also, through the examples of great personalities, that this is actually the case. When one starts making advancement in Krishna consciousness, then Maya comes and tests one severely. For instance, Haridas Thakur. When Haridas Thakur was chanting the holy names of the Lord, chanting 196 rounds a day, you know, first a prostitute comes to try to make him fall from his path. But because he was having this taste, this higher taste in Krishna consciousness, he wasn't even in the slightest interested. So instead, this prostitute, she becomes an extremely exalted devotee. She gives up her degraded profession, and she also starts chanting just like Haridas Thakur. And then Maya Devi herself comes, which is just inconceivable. I mean, even in this material world, most people are attracted by beautiful members of the opposite sex. And that's just flesh and blood that we're being attracted by. What to speak of Maya Devi herself, from whom everything else in this world is inspired by. And so even Haridas, he wasn't even interested in Maya Devi. He was so fixed in his chanting of Hare Krishna. So in the end, Maya Devi was saying, oh Haridas, I actually came to test, to see whether or not you're actually the Namacharya. And I came because I wanted to take initiation from you in these holy names. And so when one tries to make spiritual advancement in Krishna consciousness, oftentimes what we'll find pulling on us are these chains that are binding us to the material world. It's like we're getting higher and higher, almost leaving the material world, and just when we reach a certain point, we have a hard time going further because those chains, these self-inflicted chains, are binding us. So it's difficult for us to cross beyond that point. So then later, a few verses later, the text 40 in the third chapter, Krishna makes a very good point. He says the senses, the mind, and intelligence are the sitting places of this lust. Through them, lust covers real knowledge of the living entity and bewilders him. So then in the purport Prabhupada makes, he describes about the order of superiority. He describes how the mind is superior to the senses. Superior to the mind is the intelligence. Superior to the intelligence is the spirit soul directly. So even though our senses, our mind, and our intelligence may be polluted, if we can engage directly with our spirit soul, then all these other lower entities will be subdued. So by engaging in Krishna consciousness directly, circumventing the mind, circumventing the senses, just forget about them. It's been described that the mind is a non-devotee. Don't bother trying to preach to your mind because it won't be successful. Rather, engage directly from the spiritual platform in Krishna consciousness, and then your intelligence will become purified. With purified intelligence, your mind has to act properly. It's not the business of the mind to act independently. All the mind does, it takes information supplied by the intelligence, and then it either accepts it or rejects it. The business of the mind is accepting and rejecting. But if the mind is being fed garbage by the intelligence, it can't properly accept and reject. So with a lusty intelligence, the mind will naturally be corrupted. So how do we engage the intelligence? How do we purify the intelligence? We do that by coming to the Bhagavatam class. We do that by coming to the Gita class. We do that by reading Srila Prabhupada's books. Krishna says in the Gita that by studying the Bhagavad Gita, you're engaging in Krishna's, in His service with your intelligence. And by engaging in Krishna's service with our intelligence, it purifies our polluted intelligence. And so then with properly situated intelligence, our intelligence will feed the proper information to the mind. So what the intelligence does is it discriminates. Just like one with no intelligence can't discriminate whether in a poorly lit room an object is a rope or a snake. Because the room is poorly illuminated, it's very difficult to tell. So the intelligence may say, oh, this is a rope. This will be very beneficial for us. So the mind accepts what it thinks is a rope. As soon as it touches the rope, it gets bit and it dies. So by studying these transcendental literatures, it sheds light in the dark areas, in the polluted areas of our intelligence. And thus we can properly distinguish what is actually going on. And then when our mind and our senses start pushing very strongly, our intelligence can identify, no, this isn't good for us. No, we shouldn't have sex with an animal. That's not a good thing to do. And then we can avoid these very severe punishments. We can avoid these horrible silk cotton trees that have thorns like thunderbolts. And we won't be impaled on them and then torn off from them, tearing our body very severely. So that's why it's so important to take these teachings seriously, to actually read, take the austerity of reading Srila Prabhupada's books, take the austerity of attending the Bhagavatam class, of attending the Bhagavad Gita class, and then our intelligence can become purified. We can actually make some advancement in Krishna consciousness. So just a quick note on some other things happening today. Today is the anniversary of Srila Prabhupada's taking sannyas. And so this was when Prabhupada started taking, he always took the order of his spiritual master very seriously, but this is when he actually started acting on it in very in a very serious way. Because the only reason for taking sannyas is for preaching. And so Prabhupada was preparing himself for coming to the West to act on his spiritual master's order, to share these very teachings with us so we can avoid all these terrible hellish planets. I mean, just in reading the descriptions of the hellish planets, if Prabhupada hadn't come along, I can already see at least, you know, a handful of hells that I'd have to visit. And so by Prabhupada's mercy, we're being spared from all these different hellish experiences. And then the other thing that's going on today is Vishwarup Mahotsava. Honestly, I had no idea what Vishwarup Mahotsava was when I saw it on the calendar there. I was thinking, what the heck is this? So I did a search in the Vedabase, and I found out that Vishwarup is another name for Lord Anantadev. There's actually only two occurrences of Vishwarup Mahotsava in the Vedabase. One, it's the day upon which Prabhupada finished the Upadeshamrita. And two, in a conversation in Vrindavan in the early 70s, I forget exactly which date, I think it was like 72, Prabhupada is going through the different holy days with some of his disciples. Because the previous day is not only the appearance day or the disappearance day of Haridas Thakur, but it's also Ananta Chaturdasi. And so in the conversation, for whatever it's worth, Prabhupada is saying on Ananta Chaturdasi, it's like Narsingha Chaturdasi. It's the appearance day of Lord Anantadev. And on this day, everyone should fast up until 5 p.m. And then we should feast on the following day of Vishwarup Mahotsava, the festival of Vishwarup. So that's what Vishwarup Mahotsava is. So if there's any comments or questions. Yes, Prabhu in the back.
Yes, Prabhu. I always thought that for a pure Vaishnav, Maya Devi eventually surrenders up to a point. Is that true or not?
You're asking if Maya Devi surrenders unto a pure Vaishnav?
Yes, I always thought that was true. Is that true or not?
Well, I don't know necessarily about surrenders, because not every pure Vaishnava takes on disciples. But at a certain point, Maya Devi does leave the pure devotees alone. She doesn't bother them with different, you know, temptations. Like just the example of Haridas Thakur. After Maya Devi was satisfied with Haridas Thakur's devotion, she stopped trying to entice him into material enjoyment. Beyond that, I'm not really... Sure, I've never seen any statements that Maya Devi will surrender unto a devotee. I've never seen any direct statements like that. If somebody else has, you know, please. Bhrigupati Prabhu?
Yeah, I remember something I heard, but it was years ago, and I haven't heard it 4 years. I think so. That Prabhupada said, Maya Devi will test you, you know, very severely, but then when you pass all the tests and you become a pure devotee, Maya Devi will pay her obeisances and go away. But it's been years since I heard that. That's like, I'm so gone, you know. I remember definitely hearing that, but that's from the early days, and I couldn't tell you where it could be found or anything mm-hmm. like that. So.
Well, that's a little bit different. Paying respects is a little bit different than totally surrendering. Yes, Mukunda Prabhu.
Another thing is that for the pure devotee, he, through his actions, through his choices, he can turn Mahamaya into Yogamaya. Mm. And so she becomes his friend. Rather than his enemy, all the same kinds of tests that, you know, one sees in terms of negatives and the material energy, they can be positively engaged in Krishna service under the direction of a pure devotee.
Yeah, that's a very nice point. Thank you. Anyone else? Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.